Salander was happy. Her heart was pounding hard when she started up the handheld for the first time in 2 months and ventured onto the internet. Surfing on a Palm handheld with a tiny screen and a stylus was not the same thing as surfing on a PowerBook with a 17-inch screen, but she was connected. From her bed in Salgrenska, she could now reach the entire world. She started by going to a website that advertised rather uninteresting pictures by an unknown and not especially skilled amateur photographer named Gil Bates in Jobsville, Pennsylvania. Salander had once checked it out and confirmed that the town of Jobsville did not exist. Nevertheless, Bates had taken more than 200 photographs of the community and created a gallery of small thumbnails. She scrolled down to image 167 and clicked to enlarge it. It showed the church in Jobsville. She put her cursor on the spire of the church tower and clicked. She instantly got a pop-up dialogue box that asked for her ID and password. She took out her stylus and wrote the word Remarkable on the screen as her ID, and A, 89 in parentheses, capital C, lowercase x, pound sign, Magnolia, as the password. She got a dialogue box with the text, Error, you have the wrong password, and a button that said, OK, try again. Lisbeth knew that if she clicked on OK, try again, and tried a different password, she would get the same dialogue box again, for years and years, for as long as she kept trying. Instead, she clicked on the O in error. The screen went blank. Then an animated door opened, and a Lara Croft-like figure stepped out. A speech bubble materialized with a text, Who goes there? She clicked on the bubble and wrote, Wasp. She got the instant reply, Prove it, or else, as the animated Lara Croft unlocked the safety catch on her gun. Salander knew it was no empty threat. If she entered the wrong password 3 times in a row, the site would shut down, and the name Wasp would be struck from the membership list. Carefully, she entered the password, Monkey Business. The screen changed again and now had a blue background with the text, Welcome to Hacker Republic, Citizen Wasp. It has been 56 days since your last visit. There are 11 citizens online. Do you want to A. browse the forum, B. send a message, C. search the archive, D. talk, E. get laid? She clicked on D. talk, and then went to the menu selection, Who's Online?, and got a list with the names Andy, Bambi, Dakota, Jabba, Buck Rogers, Mandrake, Pred, Slip, Sister Jen, Six of One, and Trinity. Hi, gang, Wasp wrote. Wasp, that really you? Six of One wrote. Look who's back. Where have you been keeping yourself? Trinity wrote. Plague said you were in some trouble, Dakota wrote. Salander was not sure, but she suspected that Dakota was a woman. The other citizens online, including the one who called himself Sister Jen, were guys. Hacker Republic had a total, the last time she was connected, of 62 citizens, of whom 4 were female. Hi, Trinity, Wasp wrote. Hi, everybody. Why are you saying hi to Trin? Is there something on G, and is there something wrong with the rest of us? Dakota wrote. We've been dating, Trinity wrote. Wasp only hangs out with intelligent people. He got abuse from 5 directions at once. Of the 62 citizens, Wasp had met 2 face-to-face. Plague, who for some strange reason was not online, was one. Trinity was the other. He was English and lived in London. 2 years earlier she had met him for a few hours when he helped her and Blomqvist in the hunt for Harriet Wanger by doing an illegal tapping of a landline in St. Albans. Salander fumbled with the clumsy stylus and wished she had a keyboard. Still there? Mandrake wrote. She punched letters. Sorry, only have a Palm. Slow going. What happened to your computer? Pred wrote. My computer is okay. It's me that's the problem.
Tell Big Brother, Slip wrote.
I'm under arrest by the government.
What? Why?
3 chatters at once. Salander summed up her situation in 5 lines, which were greeted by a worried muttering.
How are you doing? Trinity wrote.
I have a hole in my head.
I can't tell the difference, Bambi wrote.
Wasp has always had air in her head, Sister Jen wrote.
And that was followed by a spate of disparaging remarks about Wasp's mental abilities. Salander smiled. The conversation resumed with a contribution from Dakota.
Wait, this is an attack against a citizen of Hacker Republic. How are we going to respond?
Nuclear attack on Stockholm? Six of One wrote.
No,
That will be overdoing it a bit,
Wasp wrote.
A little tiny bomb? Go jump in the lake, 600.
We could shut down Stockholm, Mandrake wrote.
A virus to shut down the government?
The citizens of Hacker Republic did not generally spread computer viruses. On the contrary, they were hackers and consequently implacable adversaries of those idiots who created viruses whose sole purpose was to sabotage the net and crash computers. The citizens were information junkies and wanted a functioning internet that they could hack. But their proposal to shut down the Swedish government was not an idle threat. Hacker Republic comprised a very exclusive club of the best, an elite force that any defence organisation in the world would have paid enormous sums to use for cyber-military purposes if the citizens could be persuaded to feel any kind of loyalty to any state, which was not very likely. But they were, every one of them, computer wizards, and they were well-versed in the art of contriving viruses. Nor did they need much convincing to carry out particular campaigns if the situation warranted. Some years earlier, a citizen of Hacker Republic, who in his private life was a software developer in California, had been cheated out of a patent by a hot dot-com company that had the nerve to take the citizen to court. This caused the activists in Hacker Republic to devote a startling amount of energy for 6 months to hacking and destroying every computer owned by that company. All the company's secrets and emails, along with some fake documents that might lead people to think that its CEO was involved in tax fraud, were gleefully posted on the net, along with information about the CEO's now not-so-secret mistress and pictures from a party in Hollywood in which he could be seen snorting cocaine. The company went under in 6 months, and several years later some members of the People's Militia in Hacker Republic, who did not easily forget an enemy, were still haunting the former CEO. If 50 of the world's foremost hackers decided to launch a coordinated attack against an entire country, the country might survive, but not without serious problems. The costs would certainly run into the billions if Salander gave it the thumbs up. She thought for a moment.
Not right now. But if things don't go the way I need them to, I might ask for help.
Just say the word, Dakota wrote. It's been a long time since we messed with the government, Mandrake wrote. I have a suggestion for reversing the tax payment system, a program that could be custom-tailored for a small country like Norway, Bambi wrote. Great, but Stockholm is in Sweden, Trinity wrote. Same difference. Here's what you could do. Salander leaned back against the pillow and followed the conversation with a smile. She wondered why she, who had such difficulty talking about herself with people of flesh and blood, could blithely reveal her most intimate secrets to a bunch of completely unknown freaks on the internet. The fact was that if Salander could claim to have any sort of family or group affiliation, then it was with these lunatics. None of them actually had a hope of helping her with the problems she had with the Swedish state, but she knew that if the need arose, they would devote both time and cunning to performing effective demonstrations of their powers. Through this network she could also find herself hideouts abroad. It had been Plague's contacts on the net who had provided her with a Norwegian passport in the name of Irene Nessa. Salander had no idea who the citizens of Hacker Republic were, and she had only a vague notion of what they did when they were not on the net. The citizens were uniformly vague about their identities. 601 had once claimed that he was a black, male American of Catholic origin living in Toronto. He could just as easily be white, female and Lutheran, and living in Skövde. The one she knew best was Plague. He had introduced her to the family, and nobody became a member of this exclusive club without very strong recommendations. And for anyone to become a member, they had also to be known personally to one other citizen. On the net, Plague was an intelligent and socially gifted citizen. In real life, he was a severely overweight and socially challenged 30-year-old living on disability benefits in Sundbyberg. He bathed too seldom, and his apartment smelled like a monkey house. Salander visited him only once in a blue moon. She was content to confine her dealings with him to the net. As the chat continued, Wasp downloaded mail that had been sent to her private mailbox at Hacker Republic. One was from another member, Poison, and contained an improved version of her program, Asphyxia 1.3, which was available in the Republic's archive for its citizens. Asphyxia was a program that could control other people's computers via the internet. Poison said that he had used it successfully and that his updated version included the latest versions of Unix, Apple, and Windows. She emailed him a brief reply and thanked him for the upgrade. During the next hour, as evening approached in the United States, another half-dozen citizens had come online and welcomed back Wasp before joining the debate. When Salander logged off, the others were discussing to what extent the Swedish Prime Minister's computer could be made to send civil but crazy emails to other heads of state. A working group had been formed to explore the matter. Salander logged off by writing a brief message.
"Keep talking, but don't do anything unless I okay it. I'll come back when I can uplink again."
Everyone sent her hugs and kisses and admonished her to keep the hole in her head warm. Only when Salander had logged out of Hacker Republic did she go into Yahoo and log on to the private news group idiotic_table. She discovered that the group had two members, herself and Blomqvist. The mailbox had one message sent on May 15th. It was titled, "Read This First."
"Hi, Sally. The situation is as follows. The police haven't found your apartment and don't have access to the DVD of Bjurman's rape. The disc is very strong evidence. I don't want to turn it over to Annika without your approval. I have the keys to your apartment and a passport in name of Nessa. But the police do have the backpack you had in Gossaberga. I don't know if it contains anything compromising."
Salander thought for a moment.
"Don't think so. A half-empty thermos of coffee, some apples, a change of clothes. No problem."
"You're going to be charged with aggravated assault against and the attempted murder of Zalachenko, and aggravated assault against Carl Magnus Lundin at Stallarholmen, i.e., because you shot him in the foot and broke his jaw when you kicked him. But a source in the police whom I trust tells me that the evidence in each case is vague. The following is important. 1. Before Zalachenko was shot, he denied everything and claimed that it could only have been Niedermann who shot and buried you. He laid a charge against you for attempting to murder him. The prosecutor is going to go on about this being the second time you have tried to kill him. 2. Neither Lundin nor Sonny Niemannen has said a word about what happened at Stallarholmen. Lundin has been arrested for kidnapping Miriam. Niemannen has been released."
Salander had already discussed all of this with Giannini. She had told Giannini everything that had happened in Gossaberga, but she had refrained from telling her anything about Bjurman.
"What I think you haven't understood are the rules of the game. It's like this. Seppo got saddled with Zalachenko in the middle of the Cold War. For 15 years he was protected, no matter what he did. Careers were built on Zalachenko. On any number of occasions, they cleaned up after his rampages. This is all criminal activity. Swedish authorities helping to cover up crimes against individual citizens. If this gets out, there'll be a scandal that will affect both the Conservative and Social Democratic parties. Above all, people in high places within Seppo will be exposed as accomplices in criminal and immoral activities. Even though by now the statute of limitations has run out on the specific instances of crime, there'll still be a scandal. It involves big shots who are either retired now or close to retirement. They will do everything they can to reduce the damage to themselves and their group, and that means you'll once again be a pawn in their game. But this time it's not a matter of them sacrificing a pawn. It'll be a matter of them actively needing to limit the damage to themselves personally. So you'll have to be locked up again. This is how it will work. They know that they can't keep the lid on the Zalachenko secret for long. I've got the story, and they know that sooner or later I'm going to publish it. It doesn't matter so much, of course, now that he's dead. What matters to them is their own survival. The following points are therefore high on their agenda. 1. They have to convince the district court, the public in effect, that the decision to lock you up in St. Stephen's in 1991 was a legitimate one, that you really were mentally ill. 2. They have to separate the Salander affair from the Zalachenko affair. They'll try to create a situation where they can say, certainly Zalachenko was a fiend, but that had nothing to do with the decision to lock up his daughter. She was locked up because she was deranged. Any claims to the contrary are the sick fantasies of bitter journalists. No, we did not assist Zalachenko in any crime. That's the delusion of a mentally ill teenage girl. 3. The problem is that if you're acquitted, it would mean that the district court finds that you're not a nutcase, and that would have to mean that locking you up in 1991 was illegal. So they have to condemn you at all costs to the locked psychiatric ward. If the court determines that you are mentally ill, the media's interest in continuing to dig around in the Salander affair will die away. That is how the media work. Are you with me?
All of this she had already worked out for herself. The problem was that she didn't know what she should do.
Lisbeth, seriously, this battle is going to be decided in the mass media and not in the courtroom. Unfortunately, the trial is going to be held behind closed doors, to protect your privacy. The day that Zalichenko was shot, there was a robbery at my apartment. There were no signs on my door of a break-in, and nothing was touched or moved, except for one thing. The holder from Bjurman's summer cabin with Bjork's report was taken. At the same time, my sister was mugged, and her copy of the report was also stolen. That folder is your most important evidence. I have let it be known that our Zalichenko documents are gone, disappeared. In fact, I had a third copy that I was going to give to Armansky. I made several copies of that one and have tucked them away in safe places. Our opponents, who include several high-powered figures and certain psychiatrists, are, of course, also preparing for the trial together with Prosecutor Ekstrom. I have a source who provides me with some info on what's going on, but I suspect that you might have a better chance of finding out the relevant information. This is urgent. The prosecutor is going to try to get you locked up in the psychiatric ward. Assisting him is your old friend, Peter Teleborian. Annika won't be able to go out and do a media campaign in the same way that the prosecution can, and does, leaking information as they see fit. Her hands are tied. But I'm not encumbered by that sort of restriction. I can write whatever I want, and I also have an entire magazine at my disposal. Two important details are still needed. One, first of all, I want to have something that shows that Prosecutor Ekstrom is working with Teleborian in some inappropriate manner, and that the objective once more is to confine you to a nut house. I want to be able to go on any talk show on TV and present documentation that annihilates the prosecution's game. Two, to wage a media war, I must be able to appear in public to discuss things that you may consider your private business. Privacy in this situation is wildly overrated in view of all that has been written about you since Easter. I have to be able to construct a completely new media image of you, even if that, in your opinion, means invading your privacy, preferably with your approval. Do you understand what I mean?
She opened the archive in idiotic underscore table. It contained 26 documents. Chapter 14. Wednesday, May 18th. Figueroa got up at 5 on Wednesday morning and went for an unusually short run before she showered and dressed in black jeans, a white top and a lightweight grey linen jacket. She made coffee, poured it into a thermos and then made sandwiches. She also strapped on a shoulder holster and took her Sig Sauer from the gun cabinet. Just after 6 she drove her white Saab 9-5 to Wittangegarten in Vellingby. Mortensen's apartment was on the top floor of a 3-story building in the suburbs. The day before, she had assembled everything that could be found out about him in the public archives. He was unmarried, but that did not mean he wasn't living with someone. He had no black marks in police records, and no great fortune, and he did not seem to lead a fast life. He very seldom called in sick. The one conspicuous thing about him was that he had licenses for no fewer than 16 weapons. 3 of them were hunting rifles, the others were handguns of various types. As long as he had a license, of course, there was no crime, but Figueroa harboured a deep scepticism about anyone who collected weapons on such a scale. The Volvo with a registration beginning KAB was in the parking lot about 30 yards from where Figueroa herself parked. She poured black coffee into a paper cup and ate a lettuce and cheese baguette. Then she peeled an orange and sucked each segment to extinction. At morning rounds, Salander was out of sorts and had a bad headache. She asked for a Tylenol, which she was immediately given. After an hour, the headache had grown worse. She rang for the nurse and asked for another Tylenol. That didn't help either. By lunchtime, she had such a headache that the nurse called Dr. Endrin, who examined her patient briskly and prescribed a powerful painkiller. Salander held the tablets under her tongue and spat them out as soon as she was alone. At 2 in the afternoon, she threw up. This recurred at around 3. At 4, Jonasson came up to the ward just as Dr. Endrin was about to go home. They conferred briefly. "She feels sick, and she has a strong headache. I gave her Dexafen. I don't understand what's going on with her.
She's been doing so well lately, it might be some sort of flu.
Does she have a fever? Asked Jonasson.
No, she had 98.6 an hour ago.
I'm going to keep an eye on her overnight.
I'll be going on vacation for 3 weeks, Endrin said. Either you or Svantesson will have to take over her case, but Svantesson hasn't had much to do with her.
I'll arrange to be her primary care doctor while you're on vacation.
Good. If there's a crisis and you need help, do call.
They paid a short visit to Salander's sick bed. She was lying with a sheet pulled up to the tip of her nose, and she looked miserable. Jonasson put his hand on her forehead and felt that it was damp. I think we'll have to do a quick examination. He thanked Dr. Endrin, and she left. At 5, Jonasson discovered that Salander had developed a temperature of 100, which was noted on her chart. He visited her 3 times that evening and noted that her temperature had remained at 100. Too high, certainly, but not so high as to present a real problem. At 8, he ordered a cranial X-ray. When the X-rays came through, he studied them intently. He could not see anything remarkable, but he did observe that there was a barely visible darker area immediately adjacent to the bullet hole. He wrote a carefully worded and non-committal comment on her chart. Radiological examination gives a basis for definitive conclusions, but the condition of the patient has deteriorated steadily during the day. It cannot be ruled out that there is a minor bleed that is not visible on the images. The patient should be confined to bed rest and kept under strict observation until further notice. Berger had received 23 emails by the time she arrived at SMP at 6:30 on Wednesday morning. One of them had the address editorial-sr@swedishradio.com. The text was short. A single word. Whore. She raised her index finger to delete the message. At the last moment she changed her mind. She went back to her inbox and opened the message that had arrived 2 days before. The sender was centraled@smpost.se. So, 2 emails with the word whore and a phony sender from the world of mass media. She created a new folder called Media Fool and saved both messages. Well, then she got busy on the morning memo. Mortensen left home at 7:40 that morning. He got into his Volvo and drove towards the city, but turned off to go across Stora Essingen and Grundal into Södermalm. He drove down Hornsgatan and across to Bellmansgatan via Brännkyrkegatan. He turned left onto Tvastgatan at the Bishop's Arms pub and parked at the corner. Just as Figueroa reached the Bishop's Arms, a van pulled out and left a parking space on Bellmansgatan at the corner with Tvastgatan. From her ideal location at the top of the hill, she had an unobstructed view. She could just see the back window of Mortensen's Volvo. Straight ahead of her, on the steep slope down towards Prisgrend, was Bellmansgatan 1. She was looking at the building from the side, so she could not see the front door itself, but as soon as anyone came out onto the street, she would see them. She had no doubt that this particular address was the reason for Mortensen's being there. It was Blomqvist's building. Figueroa could see that the area surrounding Bellmansgatan 1 would be a nightmare to keep under surveillance. The only spot from which the door to the building could be observed directly was from the promenade and footbridge on Upper Bellmansgatan near the Maria lift and the Lorinska building. There was nowhere there to park a car, and the person doing the surveillance would stand exposed on the footbridge like a swallow perched on an old telephone wire in the country. The intersection of Bellmansgatan and Tvastgatan, where Figueroa had parked, was basically the only place where she could sit in her car and have a view of the whole. She had been incredibly lucky, yet it was not a particularly good place because any alert observer would see her in her car. But she did not want to leave the car and start walking around the area. She was too easily noticeable. In her role as undercover officer, her looks worked against her. Blomqvist emerged at 9:10. Figueroa noted the time. She saw him look up at the footbridge on Upper Bellmansgatan. He started up the hill, straight towards her. She opened her handbag and unfolded a map of Stockholm, which she placed on the passenger seat. Then she opened a notebook and took a pen from her jacket pocket. She pulled out her mobile and pretended to be talking, keeping her head bent so that the hand holding her phone hid part of her face. She saw Blomqvist glance down Tvastgatan. He knew he was being watched and he must have seen Mortensen's Volvo, but he kept walking without showing any interest in the car. Acts calm and cool. Somebody should have opened the car door and scared the shit out of him.
The next moment he passed Figueroa's car. She was obviously trying to find an address on the map while she talked on the phone, but she could sense Blomqvist looking at her as she passed. Suspicious of everything around him. She saw him in the side-view mirror on the passenger side as he went on down towards Hornsgatan. She had seen him on TV a couple of times, but this was the first time she had seen him in person. He was wearing blue jeans, a T-shirt, and a grey jacket. He carried a shoulder bag, and he walked with a long, loose stride. A nice-looking man. Mortensen appeared at the corner by the Bishop's Arms and watched Blomqvist go. He had a large sports bag over his shoulder and was just finishing a call on his mobile. Figueroa expected him to follow his quarry, but to her surprise he crossed the street right in front of her car and turned down the hill towards Blomqvist's building. A second later, a man in blue overalls passed her car and caught up with Mortensen.
"Hello? Where did you come from?"
They stopped outside the door to Blomqvist's building. Mortensen punched in the code and they disappeared into the stairwell.
"They're checking the apartment. Amateur night. What the hell does he think he's doing?"
Then Figueroa raised her eyes to the rearview mirror and gave a start when she saw Blomqvist again. He was standing about 10 yards behind her, close enough that he could keep an eye on Mortensen and his buddy by looking over the crest of the steep hill down towards Bellmansgarten 1. She watched his face. He was not looking at her, but he had seen Mortensen go in through the front door of his building. After a moment, he turned on his heel and resumed his little stroll towards Hornsgarten. Figueroa sat motionless for 30 seconds.
He knows he's being watched. He's keeping track of what goes on around him. But why doesn't he react? A normal person would react, and pretty strongly at that. He must have something up his sleeve.
Blomqvist hung up and rested his gaze on the notebook on his desk. The National Vehicle Registry had just informed him that the car he had seen at the top of Bellmansgarten, with a blonde woman inside, was owned by Monica Figueroa, born in 1969, and living on Pontoniergarten in Kungsholmen. Since it was a woman in the car, Blomqvist assumed it was Figueroa herself. She had been talking on her mobile and looking at a map that was unfolded on the passenger seat. Blomqvist had no reason to believe that she had anything to do with the Zalachenko Club, but he made a note of every deviation from the norm in his working day, and especially around his neighbourhood. He called Karim in. "Who is this woman, Lotta? Dig up her passport picture, where she works, and anything else you can find." Selberg looked rather startled. He pushed away the sheet of paper with the 9 succinct points that Berger had presented at the weekly meeting of the Budget Committee. Flodin looked similarly concerned. Borgshuur appeared neutral, as always.
"This is impossible," Selberg said with a polite smile.
"How so?"
Berger said.
"The board will never go along with this. It defies all rhyme and reason."
"Shall we take it from the top?" Berger said. "I was hired to make SMP profitable again. To do that, I have to have something to work with, don't you think?"
"Well, yes, but I can't wave a magic wand and conjure up the contents of a daily newspaper by sitting in my glass cage and just wishing for things." "You don't understand the hard economic facts."
"That's possible. But I understand making newspapers. And the reality is that over the past 15 years, SMP's personnel has been reduced by 118. Half were graphic artists and so on, replaced by new technology. But the number of reporters contributing to copy was reduced by 48 during that period."
"Those were necessary cuts. If the staff hadn't been cut, the paper would have folded long ago. At least Morander understood the necessity of the reductions."
"Well, let's wait and see what's necessary and what isn't. In 3 years, 19 reporter jobs have disappeared. In addition, we now have a situation in which 9 positions at SMP are vacant and are being, to some extent, covered by temps. The sports desk is dangerously understaffed. There should be 9 employees there, and for more than a year, 2 positions have remained unfilled."
"It's a question of saving money. It's that simple."
"The culture section has 3 unfilled positions. The business section has 1. The legal desk does not even, in practice, exist. There we have a chief editor who borrows reporters from the news desk for each of his features, and so on. SMP hasn't done any serious coverage of the civil service and government agencies for at least 8 years. We depend for that on freelancers and the material from the TT wire service. And as you know, TT shut down its civil service desk some years ago.
In other words, there isn't a single news desk in Sweden covering the civil service and the government agencies.
The newspaper business is in a vulnerable position.
The reality is that SMP should either be shut down immediately, or the board should find a way to take an aggressive stance. Today we have fewer employees responsible for producing more copy every day. The articles they turn out are terrible, superficial, and they lack credibility. That's why SMP is losing its readers.
You don't understand the situation.
I'm tired of hearing that I don't understand the situation. I'm not some temp who's just here for the bus fare.
But your proposal is crazy.
Why is that?
You're proposing that the newspaper should not be profitable.
Listen, Selbeck. This year you will be paying out a huge amount of money in dividends to the paper's 23 stockholders. Add to this the unforgivably absurd bonuses that will cost SMP almost 10 million kroner for 9 individuals who sit on SMP's board. You've awarded yourself a bonus of 400,000 kroner for administering cutbacks. Of course, it's a long way from being a bonus as huge as the ones that some of the directors of Scandia grabbed, but in my eyes, you're not worth a bonus of so much as one single ora. Bonuses should be paid to people who do something to strengthen SMP. The plain truth is that your cutbacks have weakened SMP and deepened the crisis we now find ourselves in.
That is grossly unfair. The board approved every measure I proposed.
Of course the board approved your measures, because you guaranteed a dividend each year. That's what has to stop, and now.
So you're suggesting in all seriousness that the board should decide to abolish dividends and bonuses? What makes you think the stockholders would agree to that?
I'm proposing a zero-profit operating budget this year. That would mean savings of almost 21 million kroner, and the chance to beef up SMP's staff and finances. I'm also proposing wage cuts for management. I'm being paid a monthly salary of 88,000 kroner, which is utter insanity for a newspaper that can't add a job to its sports desk.
So you want to cut your own salary? Is this some sort of wage communism you're advocating?
Don't bullshit me. You make 112,000 kroner a month if you add in your annual bonus. That's crazy. If the newspaper were stable and bringing in a tremendous profit, then you could pay out as much as you wanted in bonuses. But this is no time for you to be increasing your own bonus. I propose cutting all management salaries by half.
What you don't understand is that our stockholders bought stock in the paper because they want to make money. That's called capitalism. If you arrange for them to lose money, then they won't want to be stockholders any longer.
I'm not suggesting they should lose money, though it might come to that. Ownership implies responsibility. As you yourself pointed out, capitalism is what matters here. SMP's owners want to make a profit, but it's the market that decides whether you make a profit or take a loss. By your reasoning, you want the rules of capitalism to apply solely to the employees of SMP, while you and the stockholders will be exempt.
Selberg rolled his eyes and sighed. He cast an entreating glance at Borgsjö, but the CEO was intently studying Berger's 9-point program. Figueroa waited for 49 minutes before Mortensen and his companion in overalls came out of Bellmansgarten 1. As they started up the hill towards her, she very steadily raised her Nikon, with its 300mm telephoto lens, and took 2 pictures. She put the camera in the space under her seat and was just about to fiddle with her map when she happened to glance towards the Maria lift. Her eyes opened wide. At the end of Upper Bellmansgarten, right next to the gate to the Maria lift, stood a dark-haired woman with a digital camera filming Mortensen and his companion.
What the hell? Is there some sort of spy convention on Bellmansgarten today?
The two men parted at the top of the hill without exchanging a word. Mortensen went back to his car on Tavastgarten. He pulled away from the curb and disappeared from view. Figueroa looked into her rear-view mirror, in which she could still see the back of the man in the blue overalls. She then saw that the woman with the camera had stopped filming and was heading past the Lorinska building in her direction.
Heads or tails?
She already knew who Mortensen was and what he was up to. The man in the blue overalls and the woman with the camera were unknown entities. But if she left her car, she risked being seen by the woman. She sat still. In her rearview mirror, she saw the man in the blue overalls turn into Brännkyrkagatan. She waited until the woman reached the crossing in front of her, but instead of following the man in the overalls, the woman turned 180 degrees and went down the steep hill towards Bellmansgarten 1.
Figueroa guessed that she was in her mid-thirties. She had short, dark hair and was dressed in dark jeans and a black jacket. As soon as she was a little way down the hill, Figueroa pushed open her car door and ran towards Brennkirchergarten. She could not see the blue overalls. The next second, a Toyota van pulled away from the curb. Figueroa saw the man in half-profile and memorized the registration number, but if she got the registration wrong, she would be able to trace him anyway. The sides of the van advertised Lars Falsen Lock and Key Service, with a phone number. There was no need to follow the van. She walked calmly back to the top of the hill, just in time to see the woman disappear through the door of Blomqvist's building. She got back into her car and wrote down both the registration and phone numbers for Lars Falsen. There was a lot of mysterious traffic around Blomqvist's address that morning. She looked up towards the roof of Bellmansgarten 1. She knew that Blomqvist's apartment was on the top floor, but from the blueprints from the city construction office, she knew that it was on the other side of the building, with dormer windows looking out on Gamlestan and the waters of Riddarfjorden. An exclusive address in a fine old cultural quarter. She wondered whether he was an ostentatious nouveau riche. 10 minutes later, the woman with the camera came out of the building again. Instead of going back up the hill to Tavastgarten, she continued down the hill and turned right at the corner of Prisgrend. If she had a car parked down on Prisgrend, Figueroa was out of luck. But if she was walking, there was only one way out of the dead end, up to Brennkirchergarten via Pustergrend and towards Slusen. Figueroa decided to leave her car behind and turned left in the direction of Slusen on Brennkirchergarten. She had almost reached Pustergrend when the woman appeared, coming up towards her. Bingo. She followed her past the Hilton on Södermalmstorg and past the Staatsmuseum at Slusen. The woman walked quickly and purposefully, without once looking around. Figueroa gave her a lead of about 30 yards. When she went into Slusen Tunnelbana, Figueroa picked up her pace, but stopped when she saw the woman head for the Pressbüren kiosk instead of through the turnstiles. She watched the woman as she stood in line at the kiosk. She was about 5'7" and looked to be in pretty good shape. She was wearing running shoes. Seeing her with both feet planted firmly as she stood by the window of the kiosk, Figueroa suddenly had the feeling that she was a policewoman. She bought a tin of catch-dry snuff and went back out onto Södermalmstorg and turned right across Katharinavägen. Figueroa followed. She was almost certain the woman had not seen her. The woman turned the corner at McDonald's, and Figueroa hurried after her, but when she got to the corner, the woman had vanished without a trace. Figueroa stopped short in consternation. Shit. She walked slowly past the entrances to the buildings. Then she caught sight of a brass plate that read, Milton Security. Figueroa walked back to Bellmansgarten. She drove to Guttgarten, where the offices of Millennium were, and spent the next half hour walking around the streets in the area. She did not see Mortensen's car. At lunchtime she returned to police headquarters in Kungsholmen and spent 2 hours thinking, as she pumped iron in the gym.
"We have a problem," Cortez said.
Eriksson and Blomqvist looked up from the manuscript of the book about the Zalachenko case. It was 1:30 in the afternoon.
"Take a seat," Eriksson said.
"It's about Vitavara, Inc., the company that makes the 1700 kronor toilets in Vietnam."
"What's the problem?" Blomqvist said.
"Vitavara, Inc. is a wholly owned subsidiary of Svea Construction, Inc."
"I see. That's a very large firm."
"Yes, it is. The chairman of the board is Magnus Borgshaw, a professional board member. He's also the CEO of Svenska Morgonposten, and owns about 10% of it."
Blomqvist gave Cortez a sharp look.
"Are you sure?"
"Yep. Berger's boss is a fucking crook, a man who exploits child labour in Vietnam."
Assistant editor Fredriksson looked to be in a bad mood as he knocked on the door of Berger's glass cage at 2 in the afternoon.
"What is it?"
"Well, this is a little embarrassing, but somebody in the newsroom got an email from you."
"From me? So, what does it say?"
He handed her some printouts of emails addressed to Eva Carlson, a 26-year-old temp on the culture pages. According to the headers, the sender was erika.berger@smpost.se. "Darling Eva, I want to caress you and kiss your breasts. I'm hot with excitement
and can't control myself. I beg you to reciprocate my feelings. Could we meet? Erica. And then two emails on the following days. Dearest, darling Eva, I beg you not to reject me. I'm crazy with desire. I want to have you naked. I have to have you. I'm going to make you so happy. You'll never regret it. I'm going to kiss every inch of your naked skin, your lovely breasts, and your delicious grotto. Erica. Eva, why don't you reply? Don't be afraid of me. Don't push me away. You're no innocent. You know what it's all about. I want to have sex with you, and I'm going to reward you handsomely. If you're nice to me, then I'll be nice to you. You've asked for an extension of your temporary job. I have the power to extend it, and even make it a full-time position. Let's meet tonight at 9 by my car in the garage. Yours, Erica.
All right, Berger said. And now she's wondering if I really sent these to her, is that it?
Not exactly. I mean, geez.
Peter, please speak up.
She sort of halfway believed the first email, although she was surprised by it, but she realized this isn't exactly your style, and then...
Then?
Well, she thinks it's embarrassing, and doesn't know what to do. Part of it is probably that she's very impressed by you and likes you a lot, as a boss, I mean, so she came to me and asked for my advice.
And what did you tell her?
I said that someone had faked your address, and is obviously harassing her, or possibly both of you. I said I'd talk to you about it.
Thank you. Could you please ask her to come to my office in 10 minutes?
In the meantime, Berger composed her own email.
It has come to my attention that an employee of SMP has received a number of emails that appear to come from me. The emails contain vulgar sexual innuendos. I have also received similar emails from a sender who purports to be Central Ed at SMP. No such address exists. I have consulted the head of the IT department, who informs me that it is very easy to fake a sender's address. I don't understand how it's done, but there are sites on the internet where such things can be arranged. I have to draw the conclusion that some sick individual is doing this. I want to know if any other colleagues have received strange emails. If so, I would like them to inform Fredrickson of this immediately. If these unpleasant pranks continue, we will have to consider reporting them to the police. Erika Berger, Editor-in-Chief.
She printed a copy of the email and then pressed send so that the message went out to all employees in the company. At that moment, Eva Carlson knocked on the door.
Hello. Have a seat, Berger said. Peter told me that you got an email from me.
Well, I didn't really think it came from you.
30 seconds ago you did get an email from me. I wrote it all by myself and sent it to everyone in the company.
She handed Carlson the printout.
Okay, I get it, the girl said. I'm really sorry that somebody decided to target you for this ugly campaign. You don't have to apologize for the actions of some asshole. I just want to make sure that you don't have any lingering suspicions that I had anything to do with these emails. I never believed you sent them. Thanks,
Berger said with a smile. Figueroa spent the afternoon gathering information. She started by ordering passport photographs of Falsen. Then she ran a check in the criminal records and got a hit at once. Lars Falsen, 47 years old and known by the nickname Fallon, had begun his criminal career stealing cars at 17. In the 70s and 80s, he was arrested twice and charged with breaking and entering, burglary, and receiving stolen goods. The first time he was given a light prison sentence, the second time he got 3 years. At that time, he was regarded as up-and-coming in criminal circles and had been questioned as a suspect in 3 other burglaries, one of which was a relatively complicated and widely reported safe-cracking heist at a department store in Västerås. When he got out of prison in 1984, he kept his nose clean, or at least he did not pull any jobs that got him arrested and convicted again. But he had retrained himself to be a locksmith, of all professions, and in 1987 he started his own company, Lars Falsen Lock and Key Service, with an address near Nortul in Stockholm. Identifying the woman who had filmed Mortensen and Falsen proved to be easier than she had anticipated. She simply called Milton Security and explained that she was looking for a female employee she had met a while ago and whose name she had forgotten. She could give a good description of the woman. The switchboard told her that it sounded like Suzanne Linda and put her through. When Linda answered the phone, Figueroa apologized and said she must have dialed the wrong number. The public registry listed 18 Suzanne Linders in Stockholm County, three of them around 35 years old. One lived in Norrtälje, one in Stockholm, and one in Nacka. She requisitioned their passport photographs and identified at once the woman she had followed from Bellmansgarten as the Suzanne Linder who lived in Nacka. She set out her day's work in a memo and went in to see Ed Klimth. Blomqvist closed Cortez's research folder and pushed it away with distaste. Malm put down the printout of his article, which he had read four times. Cortez sat on the sofa in Erickson's office, looking guilty.
"Coffee," Erickson said, getting up.
She came back with four mugs and the coffee pot.
"This is a great, sleazy story," Blomqvist said. "First-class research. Documentation to the hilt. Perfect dramaturgy, with a bad guy who swindles Swedish tenants through the system, which is legal, but who is so greedy and so fucking stupid that he outsources to this company in Vietnam."
"Very well written, too," Malm said. "The day after we publish this, Borgshaw is going to be persona non grata. TV is going to pick this up. He's going to be right up there with the directors of Scandia. A genuine scoop for Millennium. Well done, Henry."
"But this thing with Erica is a real fly in the ointment," Blomqvist said.
"Why should that be a problem?" Erickson said. "Erica isn't the villain. We have to be free to examine any chairman of the board or CEO, even if he happens to be her boss."
"It's a hell of a dilemma," Blomqvist said.
"Erica hasn't completely left Millennium," Malm said. "She owns 30% and sits on our board. In fact, she's chairman of the board until we can elect Harriet Wanger at the next board meeting, and that won't be until August. Plus, Erica is working at SMP, and you're about to expose her boss."
Glum silence.
"So what the hell are we going to do?" Cortez said. "Do we kill the article?"
Blomqvist looked Cortez straight in the eye.
"No, Henry, we're not going to kill the article. That's not the way we do things at Millennium. But this is going to take some legwork. We can't just dump it on Erica's desk as a newspaper headline."
Malm waved a finger in the air.
"We're really putting Erica on the spot. She'll have to sell her share of Millennium and leave our board. Or in the worst case, she could get fired by SMP. Either way, she would have a terrible conflict of interest. Honestly, Henry, I agree with Mikael that we should publish the story, but we may have to postpone it for a month."
"Because we're facing a conflict of loyalties too," Blomqvist said.
"Should I call her?"
"No, Krista," Blomqvist said. "I'll call her and arrange to meet. Tonight." Figueroa gave a summary of the circus that had sprung up around Blomqvist's building on Bellmansgarten. Ed Klimth felt the floor sway slightly beneath his chair.
"An employee of SIS goes into Blomqvist's building with an ex-safebreaker, now retrained as a locksmith."
"Correct.
What do you think they did in the stairwell?"
"I don't know, but they were in there for 49 minutes. My guess is that Folsen opened the door and Mortensen spent the time in Blomqvist's apartment."
"And what did they do there?"
"It couldn't have been to plant bugs, because that takes only a minute or so. Mortensen must have been looking through Blomqvist's papers or whatever else he keeps at his place."
"But Blomqvist has already been warned. They stole Björk's report from there."
"Right. He knows he's being watched, and he's watching the ones who are watching him. He's calculating."
"Calculating what?"
"I mean, he has a plan. He's gathering information and is going to expose Mortensen. That's the only reasonable explanation."
"And this Linder woman?"
"Suzanne Linder, former police officer."
"Police officer?"
"She graduated from the police academy and worked for 6 years on the Södermalm crime team. She resigned abruptly. There's nothing in her file that says why. She was out of a job for several months before she was hired by Milton Security."
"Armansky," Ed Klimth said thoughtfully. "How long was she in the building?"
9 minutes.
"Doing what?"
"Since she was filming Mortensen and Falsen on the street, I'm guessing that she's documenting their activities. That means that Milton Security is working with Blomqvist and has placed surveillance cameras in his apartment or in the stairwell. She probably went in to collect the film."
Ed Klimth sighed. The Zalachenko story was beginning to get tremendously complicated.
"Thank you. You go home.
I have to think about this."
Figueroa went to the gym at St. Eric's Plan.
Blomqvist used his second mobile when he punched in Berger's number at SMP. He interrupted a discussion she was having with her editors about what angle to give an article on international terrorism.
"Oh, hello, it's you. Wait a second."
Berger put her hand over the mouthpiece.
"I think we're done,"
she said, and gave them one last instruction. When she was alone, she said,
"Hello, Mikhail. Sorry not to have been in touch. I'm just so swamped here. There are 1,000 things I've got to learn. How's the Salander stuff going?"
"Good, but that's not why I called. I have to see you. Tonight."
"I wish I could, but I have to be here until 8, and I'm dead tired. I've been at it since dawn. What's it about?"
"I'll tell you when I see you, but it's not good."
"I'll come to your place at 8:30.
"No, not at mine. It's a long story, but my apartment is unsuitable for the time being. Let's meet at Samir's Cauldron for a beer."
"I'm driving."
"Then we'll have a light beer."
Berger was slightly annoyed when she walked into Samir's Cauldron. She was feeling guilty because she had not contacted Blomqvist even once since the day she had walked into SMP. Blomqvist waved from a corner table. She stopped in the doorway. For a second, he seemed a stranger.
"Who's that over there? God, I'm so tired."
Then he stood and kissed her on the cheek, and she realized, to her dismay, that she had not even thought about him for several weeks, and that she missed him terribly. It was as though her time at SMP had been a dream, and she might suddenly wake up on the sofa at Millennium. It felt unreal.
"Hello, Mikhail."
"Hello, Editor-in-Chief. Have you eaten?"
"It's 8:30. I don't have your disgusting eating habits."
Samir came over with the menu, and she realized she was hungry. She ordered a beer and a small plate of calamari with Greek potatoes. Blomqvist ordered couscous and a beer.
"How are you?"
she said.
"These are interesting times we're living in. I'm swamped, too."
"And Salander?"
"She's part of what makes it so interesting."
"Mika, I'm not going to steal your story."
"I'm not trying to evade your question. The truth is that right now everything is a little confused. I'd love to tell you the whole thing, but it would take half the night. How do you like being editor-in-chief?"
"It's not exactly Millennium. I fall asleep like a blown-out candle as soon as I get home, and when I wake up I see spreadsheets before my eyes. I've missed you. Can't we go back to your place and sleep? I don't have the energy for sex, but I'd love to curl up and sleep next to you."
"I'm sorry, Ricky. The apartment isn't a good place right now."
"Why not? Has something happened?"
"Well, the spooks have bugged the place, and they listen, presumably, to every word I say. I've had cameras installed to record what happens when I'm not home. I don't think we should let the state archives have footage of your naked posterior."
"Are you kidding?"
"No. But that wasn't why I had to see you tonight."
"What is it? Tell me."
"Well, I'll be very direct. We've come across a story that will sink your CEO. It's about using child labour and exploiting political prisoners in Vietnam. We're looking at a conflict of interest."
Berger put down her fork and stared at him. She saw at once that he was not being funny.
"This is how things stand," he said. "Borgsjö is chairman and majority stockholder of a company called Svea Construction, which in turn is sole owner of a subsidiary called Vitavara, Inc. They make toilets at a factory in Vietnam which has been condemned by the UN for using child labour."
"Run that by me again."
Blomqvist told her the details of the story that Cortez had compiled. He opened his laptop bag and took out a copy of the documentation. Berger read slowly through the article. Finally, she looked up and met Blomqvist's eyes. She felt unreasoning panic, mixed with disbelief.
"Why the hell is it that the first thing Millennium does after I leave is to start running background checks on SMP's board members?"
"That's not what happened, Ricky."
He explained how the story had developed.
"And how long have you known about this?"
"Since today. Since this afternoon. I feel deeply uncomfortable about how this has unfolded."
"And what are you going to do?"
"I don't know. We have to publish. We can't make an exception just because it deals with your boss. But not one of us wants to hurt you."
He threw up his hands.
"We're all extremely unhappy about the situation. Henry especially."
"I'm still a member of Millennium's board. I'm a part owner. It's going to be viewed as..."
"I know exactly how it's going to be viewed. You're going to land in a shitload of trouble at SMP."
Berger felt weariness settling over her. She clenched her teeth and stifled an impulse to ask Blomqvist to sit on the story.
"God damn it," she said. "And there's no doubt in your mind?"
Blomqvist shook his head.
I spent the whole afternoon going over Henry's documentation. We have Borgshu ready for the slaughter.
So what are you planning? And when?
What would you have done if we'd uncovered this story 2 months ago? Beggar looked intently at her friend, who had also been her lover over the past 20 years. Then she lowered her eyes.
You know what I would have done.
This is a disastrous coincidence. None of it is directed at you. I'm terribly, terribly sorry. That's why I insisted on seeing you at once. We have to decide what to do.
We?
Listen, the story was slated to run in the June issue. I've killed that idea. The earliest it could come out is August, and it can be postponed further if you need more time.
I understand.
Her voice took on a bitter tone. I suggest we don't decide anything now. Take the documentation and go home and think it over. Don't do anything until we can agree on a common strategy. We have time.
A common strategy?
You either have to resign from Millennium's board before we publish, or resign from SMP. You can't wear both hats. She nodded.
I'm so linked to Millennium that no one will believe I didn't have a hand in this, whether I resign or not.
There is an alternative. You could take the story to SMP and confront Borgshu and demand his resignation. I'm quite sure Henry would agree to that. But don't do anything until we all agree.
So I start by getting the person who recruited me fired.
I'm sorry.
He isn't a bad person.
I believe you. But he's greedy. Beggar got up.
I'm going home.
Ricky, she interrupted him.
I'm just dead tired. Thanks for warning me. I'll let you know.
She left without kissing him, and he had to pay the bill. Berger had parked 200 yards from the restaurant and was halfway to her car when she felt such strong heart palpitations that she had to stop and lean against a wall. She felt sick. She stood for a long time breathing in the mild May air. She had been working 15 hours a day since May 1st. That was almost 3 weeks. How would she feel after 3 years? Was that how Miranda had felt before he dropped dead in the newsroom? After 10 minutes, she went back to Samir's cauldron and ran into Blomqvist as he was coming out the door. He stopped in surprise.
Erika!
Mika, don't say a word. We've been friends so long. Nothing can destroy that. You're my best friend, and this feels exactly like the time you disappeared to Hedestad 2 years ago, only vice versa. I feel stressed out and unhappy.
He put his arms around her. She felt tears in her eyes.
3 weeks at SMP have already done me in, she said.
Now, now. It takes more than that to do an Erika Berger.
Your apartment is compromised, and I'm too tired to drive home. I'd fall asleep at the wheel and die in a crash. I've decided. I'm going to walk to the Scandic Crown and book a room. Come with me.
It's called the Hilton now.
Same difference.
They walked the short distance without talking. Blomqvist had his arm around her shoulder. Berger glanced at him and saw that he was just as tired as she was. They went straight to the front desk, took a double room, and paid with Berger's credit card. When they got to the room, they undressed, showered, and crawled into bed. Berger's muscles ached as though she had just run the Stockholm Marathon. They cuddled for a while, and then both fell asleep in seconds. Neither of them had noticed the man in the lobby, who was watching them as they stepped into the elevator. Chapter 15. Thursday, May 19th, to Sunday, May 22nd. Salander spent most of Wednesday night and early Thursday morning reading Blomqvist's articles and the chapters of the Millennium book that were more or less finished. Since Prosecutor Ekstrom had tentatively referred to a trial in July, Blomqvist had set June 20th as his deadline for going to press. That meant that Blomqvist had about a month to finish writing and patching up all the holes in his text. She could not imagine how he could finish in time, but that was his problem, not hers. Her problem was how to respond to his questions. She took her palm and logged on to the Yahoo group idiotic_table to check whether he had put up anything new in the past 24 hours. He had not. She opened the document that he had called Central Questions. She knew the text by heart already, but she read through it again anyway. He outlined the strategy that Giannini had already explained to her. When her lawyer spoke to her, she had listened with only half an ear, almost as though it had nothing to do with her. But Blomqvist, knowing things about her that Giannini did not, could present a more forceful strategy. She skipped down to the fourth paragraph. "The only person who can decide your future is you. It doesn't matter how hard Annika works for you, or how much Armansky and Palmgren and I and others want to support you. I'm not going to try to convince you one way or the other. You have to decide for yourself. You can turn the trial to your advantage, or you can let them convict you. But if you want to win, you're going to have to fight." She disconnected and looked up at the ceiling. Blomqvist was asking her for permission to tell the truth in his book. He was not going to mention the fact of Bjurman's raping her, and he had already written that section. He had filled in the gaps by saying that Bjurman had made a deal with Zalachenko which collapsed when Bjurman lost control. Therefore, Niedermann was obliged to kill him. Blomqvist did not speculate about Bjurman's motives. Kalle fucking Blomqvist was complicating life for her. At 2 in the morning, she opened the word processing program on her palm. She clicked on New Document, took out the stylus, and began to tap on the letters on the digital keypad.
"My name is Lisbeth Salander. I was born on April 30th, 1978. My mother was Agneta Sophia Salander. She was 22 when I was born. My father was a psychopath, killer, and batterer whose name was Alexander Zalachenko. He previously worked in Western Europe for the Soviet Military Intelligence Service, GRU.
It was a slow process, writing with a stylus on the keypad. She thought through each sentence before she tapped it in. She did not make a single change to what she had written. She worked until 4, then turned off her computer and put it in the charger in the recess at the back of her bedside table. By that time she had produced a document corresponding to 2 single-spaced pages. Twice since midnight the duty nurse had put her head around the door, but Salander could hear her a long way off, and even before she turned the key the computer was hidden and the patient asleep. Berger woke at 7. She felt far from rested, but she had slept uninterrupted for 8 hours. She glanced at Blomqvist, who was still sleeping soundly beside her. She turned on her mobile to check for messages. Gregor Beckmann, her husband, had called 11 times.
Shit, I forgot to call.
She dialed the number and explained where she was and why she had not come home. He was angry.
Erika, don't do that again. It has nothing to do with me, Kyle, but I've been worried sick all night. I was terrified that something had happened. You know you have to call and tell me if you're not coming home. You can't ever forget something like that.
Beckmann was completely okay with the fact that Blomqvist was his wife's lover. Their affair was carried on with his assent. But every time she had decided to sleep at Blomqvist's, she had called her husband to tell him.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I just collapsed in exhaustion last night."
He grunted.
"Try not to be furious with me, Gregor. I can't handle it right now. You can give me hell tonight."
He grunted some more and promised to scold her when she got home.
"Okay. How's Mikhail doing?"
"He's dead to the world," she burst out, laughing. "Believe it or not, we were fast asleep moments after we got here. That's never happened."
"This is serious, Erika. I think you ought to see a doctor."
When she hung up, she called the office and left a message for Fredriksson. Something had come up and she would be in a little later than usual. She asked him to cancel a meeting she'd arranged with the culture editor. She found her shoulder bag, ferreted out a toothbrush, and went to the bathroom. Then she got back into bed and woke Blomqvist.
"Hurry up. Go and wash your face and brush your teeth."
"What?
Huh?"
He sat up and looked around in bewilderment. She had to remind him that he was at the Slusen Hilton. He nodded.
"So, to the bathroom with you."
"Why the hurry?"
"Because as soon as you come back, I need you to make love to me."
She glanced at her watch.
"I have a meeting at 11 that I can't postpone. I have to look presentable, and it'll take me at least 30 minutes to put on my face. And I'll have to buy a new shift dress or something on the way to work. That gives us only 2 hours to make up for a whole lot of lost time."
Blomqvist headed for the bathroom. Holmberg parked his father's Ford in the drive of former Prime Minister Thorbjørn Feldin's house in Os, just outside Ramvik in Hernesand County. He got out of the car and looked around. At the age of 79, Feldin could hardly still be an active farmer, and Holberg wondered who did the sowing and harvesting. He knew he was being watched from the kitchen window. That was the custom in the village. He himself had grown up in Helledal, outside Ramvik, very close to Sandebron, which was one of the most beautiful places in the world. At least Holmberg thought so. He knocked on the front door. The former leader of the Centre Party looked old, but he seemed alert and vigorous.
"Hello, Thorbjörn. My name is Jerka Holmberg. We've met before, but it's been a few years. My father is Gustav Holmberg, a delegate for the Centre in the 70s and 80s.
"Yes, I recognize you, Jerker. Hello. You're a policeman down in Stockholm now, aren't you? It must be 10 or 15 years since I last saw you."
"I think it's probably longer than that. May I come in?"
Holmberg sat at the kitchen table while Feldin poured them some coffee.
"I hope all's well with your father. But that's not why you came, is it?"
"No, Dad's doing fine. He's out repairing the roof of the cabin.
How old is he now?"
"He turned 71 2 months ago."
"Is that so?"
Feldin said, joining Holmberg at the kitchen table.
"So, what's this visit all about, then?"
Holmberg looked out the window and saw a magpie land next to his car and peck at the ground. Then he turned to Feldin.
"I am sorry for coming to see you without warning, but I have a big problem. It's possible that when this conversation is over, I'll be fired from my job. I'm here on a work issue, but my boss, Criminal Inspector Jan Boblanski of the Violent Crimes Division in Stockholm, doesn't know I'm here."
"That sounds serious."
"Just say that I'd be on very thin ice if my superiors found out about this visit."
"I understand.
On the other hand, I'm afraid that if I don't do something, there's a risk that a woman's rights will be shockingly violated, and to make matters worse, it'll be the second time it's happened."
"You'd better tell me the whole story."
"It's about a man named Alexander Zalachenko. He was an agent for the Soviet's GRU and defected to Sweden on election day in 1976. He was given asylum and began to work for SEPO. I have reason to believe that you know his story."
Feldin regarded Holmberg attentively.
"It's a long story,"
Holmberg said. And he began to tell Feldin about the preliminary investigation in which he had been involved for the past few months. Erika Berger finally rolled over onto her stomach and rested her head on her fists. She broke out in a big smile.
"Mikhail, have you ever wondered if the two of us aren't completely nuts?"
"What do you mean?"
"It's true for me, at least. I'm smitten by an insatiable desire for you. I feel like a crazy teenager."
"Oh, yes?"
"And then I want to go home and go to bed with my husband."
Blomqvist laughed.
"I know a good therapist."
She poked him in the stomach.
"Mikhail, it's starting to feel like this thing with SMP was one big fucking mistake."
"Bullshit. It's a huge opportunity for you. If anyone can inject life into that dying body, it's you."
"Maybe so. But that's just the problem. SMP feels like a cadaver. And then you dropped that bombshell about Borgshu."
"You have to let things settle down."
"I know. But the thing with Borgshu is going to be a real problem. I don't have the faintest idea how to handle it."
"Nor do I. But we'll think of something."
She was quiet for a moment.
"I miss you."
"I'll miss you too."
"How much would it take for you to come to SMP and be the news editor?"
"I wouldn't do it for anything. Isn't what's-his-name Holm the news editor?"
"Yes, but he's an idiot."
"You got that right."
"Do you know him?"
"I certainly do. I worked for him for 3 months as a temp in the mid-80s. He's a prick who plays people off against each other. Besides..."
"Besides what?"
"It's nothing."
"Tell me."
"Some girl, Ulla something, who was also a temp, claimed that he sexually harassed her. I don't know how much was true, but the union did nothing about it and her contract wasn't extended."
Berger looked at the clock and sighed. She got up from the bed and made for the shower. Blomqvist did not move when she came out, dried herself and dressed.
"I think I'll doze for a while," he said.
She kissed his cheek and waved as she left. Figueroa parked 7 cars behind Mortensen's Volvo on Lundmakergaten, close to the corner of Olaf Palme's gate. She watched as Mortensen walked to the machine to pay his parking fee. He then walked onto Sveavägen. Figueroa decided not to pay for a ticket. She would lose him if she went to the machine and back, so she followed him. He turned left onto Kungsgarten and went into Kungstornet. She waited 3 minutes before she followed him into the café. He was on the ground floor talking to a blonde man who looked to be in very good shape. A policeman, she thought. She recognized him as the other man Malm had photographed outside the Copacabana on May Day. She bought herself a coffee and sat at the opposite end of the café and opened her Dagens Nyheter. Mortensen and his companion were talking in low voices. She took out her mobile and pretended to make a call, although neither of the men was paying her any attention. She took a photograph with a mobile that she knew would be only 72 dpi, low quality, but it could be used as evidence that the meeting had taken place. After about 15 minutes, the blonde man stood up and left the café. Figueroa cursed. Why had she not stayed outside? She would have recognized him when he came out. She wanted to leap up and follow him. But Mortensen was still there, calmly nursing his coffee. She did not want to draw attention to herself by leaving so soon after his unidentified companion. And then Mortensen went to the toilet. As soon as he closed the door, Figueroa was on her feet and back out on Kungsgarten. She looked up and down the block, but the blonde man was gone. She took a chance and hurried to the corner of Sveavägen. She could not see him anywhere, so she went down to the Tunnelbana concourse, but it was hopeless. She turned back towards Kungstornet, feeling stressed. Mortensen had left, too. Berger swore when she got back to where she had parked her BMW the night before. The car was still there, but during the night, some bastard had punctured all 4 tires.
"Goddamn fucking piss rats," she fumed.
She called the vehicle recovery service, told them that she did not have time to wait and put the key in the exhaust pipe. Then she went down to Hornsgarten and hailed a taxi. Lisbeth Salander logged on to Hacker Republic and saw that Plague was online. She pinged him.
"Hi, Wasp. How's Solgrenska?" "Restful. I need your help."
"Shoot."
"I never thought I'd have to ask this."
"It must be serious."
"Göran Mortensen, living in Vällingby. I need access to his computer."
"Okay.
Everything on it has to be copied to Blomqvist at Millennium."
"I'll deal with it."
"Big Brother is bugging Blomqvist's phone and probably his email. You'll have to send the material to a Hotmail address."
"Okay."
"If I can't be reached for any reason, Blomqvist is going to need your help. He has to be able to contact you."
"Oh?"
"He's a bit square, but you can trust him."
"Hmm."
"How much do you want?"
Plague went quiet for a few seconds. "Does this have something to do with your situation?"
"Yes."
"Then I'll do it for nothing."
"Thanks, but I always pay my debts. I'm going to need your help all the way to the trial. I'll send you 30,000.
"Can you afford it?"
"I can."
"Then okay."
"I think we're going to need Trinity, too. Can you persuade him to come to Sweden?"
"To do what?"
"What he's best at. I'll pay him a standard fee plus expenses."
"Okay. What is this job?" She explained what she needed to have done. On Friday morning, Jonasson was faced with an obviously irritated Inspector Faster on the other side of his desk.
"I don't understand this," Faster said. "I thought Salander had recovered. I come to Göteborg for 2 reasons, to interview her and to get her ready to be transferred to a cell in Stockholm where she belongs."
"I'm sorry for your wasted journey," Jonasson said. "I'd be glad to discharge her because we certainly don't have any beds to spare here, but..."
"Could she be faking?"
Jonasson smiled politely.
"I really don't think so. You see, Lisbeth Salander was shot in the head. I removed a bullet from her brain, and it was 50-50 whether she would survive. She did survive, and her prognosis has been exceedingly satisfactory, so much so that my colleagues and I were getting ready to discharge her. Then yesterday she had a setback. She complained of severe headaches and developed a fever that has been fluctuating up and down. Last night she had a temperature of 100 and vomited on 2 occasions. During the night the fever subsided. She was almost back down to normal, and I thought the episode had passed. But when I examined her this morning, her temperature had gone up to over 102. That is serious."
"So what's wrong with her?"
"I don't know. But the fact that her temperature is fluctuating indicates that it's not flu or any other viral infection. Exactly what's causing it, I can't say.
It could be something as simple as an allergy to her medication or to something else she's come into contact with. He clicked on an image on his computer and turned the screen towards Faster.
I had a cranial X-ray done. There's a darker area here, as you can see, right next to her gunshot wound. I can't determine what it is. It could be scar tissue as a product of the healing process, but it could also be a minor hemorrhage. And until we found out what's wrong, I can't release her, no matter how urgent it may be from a police point of view.
Vesta knew better than to argue with a doctor, since they were the closest things to God's representatives here on Earth. Policemen possibly accepted.
What is going to happen now?
I've ordered complete bed rest and put her physical therapy on hold. She needs therapeutic exercise because of the wounds in her shoulder and hip.
Understood. I'll have to call Prosecutor Ekstrom in Stockholm. This will come as a bit of a surprise. What can I tell him?
2 days ago, I was ready to approve a discharge, possibly for the end of this week. As the situation is now, it will take longer. You'll have to prepare him for the fact that probably I won't be in a position to make a decision in the coming week, and that it might be 2 weeks before you can move her to Stockholm. It depends on her rate of recovery.
The trial has been set for July.
Barring the unforeseen, she shall be on her feet well before then.
Boblansky cast a sceptical glance at the muscular woman on the other side of the table. They were drinking coffee in the outdoor area of a café on Nor Mellestrand. It was Friday, May 20th, and the warmth of summer was in the air. Inspector Monica Figueroa, her ID said. SIS. She had caught up with him just as he was leaving for home and suggested a conversation over a cup of coffee. At first he had been surly, but she had very straightforwardly conceded that she had no authority to interview him and that he was perfectly free to tell her nothing at all if he did not want to. He asked her what her business was, and she told him that she had been assigned by her boss to form an unofficial picture of what was true and not true in the so-called Zalichenko case, also known in some quarters as the Salander case.
"What would you like to know?"
Boblansky said at last.
"Tell me what you know about Salander, Mikhail Blomqvist, Gunnar Bjork and Zalichenko. How do the pieces fit together?"
They talked for more than 2 hours.